right. Well, fantastic. Well, welcome everyone to the LHLN Live conference call, first one of 2018. So happy New Year to everyone. Wanted to welcome you in, whether it's your first time calling or you're definitely one of the ones that are one of our loved, valued callers that call every single month. Really excited for this month's call. We have a fantastic guest speaker. First, I just want to introduce my other co-host, Maria Johnson.
Hey, everybody.
And Andy Marks.
Hey, everybody.
So we're excited to kick off another year of LHLN Live, and it's been an awesome 2017. We had a lot of new callers come in, so thanks all for being here and making this a success. I'm going to quick mute everybody.
The conference has been muted.
Okay. Can you hear me? Oh, you can hear me. I hope you can hear me. Chris?
We can hear you.
Okay, thank you. Chris, star seven? Well, while she's star seven, sir, I want to introduce our guest speaker is Chris Irv. She's been diagnosed for about 5.5 years. We're actually probably diagnosed around the same time, which is crazy. I met Chris, we were trying to decide this. Maybe my first or second appointment at Dr. Sadoun's office. Of course, I'm totally that person, and I'm like, is there other people with LHLN here? I want to meet them because I was dying to meet somebody else with LHLN. I think we can all relate to that. So I got to actually meet Chris in the doctor's office. And from there, it's history. And Chris, do we have you yet? Star 7? Bottom left-hand button? And what above that? We'll give a couple more seconds. No? Chris?
The conference has been unmuted.
Jessica?
Okay, yes.
Can you hear me? Jessica?
Yes?
You can hear me?
I can, but I just unmuted the whole call.
Oh.
It's okay.
Well, I pushed star, it's star seven, right?
Uh-huh.
Well, I pushed it. But you had to unmute everybody?
That's okay. If everybody will mute their phones, I do hear some background noise, so that would be awesome. You can star six to mute you. Mute on your iPhone or star six if you have a landline. Just so we can get everyone muted. That would be awesome.
Well, do you want to try it again? I'll try star seven.
No, I think we're okay. I hear a couple more people just to mute themselves. Perfect. I don't hear too much, so I think we're all right.
Okay.
I do hear a little bit of an echo, so if there's two people in the same room, if one will just be off speakerphone, that'd be awesome too. Oh, perfect. Thank you so much. Okay, Chris.
Okay. Okay. Happy New Year, everybody. I want to start off by saying a little preface here that I've been on this phone call since its inception, and I think I've only maybe missed 4 phone calls. So I've been following along and listening to most all of these phone calls, and I found that most of the speakers have been quite inspiring to me. I, on the other hand, am not going to be, this is not going to be an inspirational phone call. I am going to talk to you about my journey, and it's a journey of how I came out of a sad, state. I started off being depressed with my diagnosis, and that's what I'm going to be speaking to you about. It's a story of how I came to terms with all of this and turned my life around and became hopeful and happy. That's the story you'll hear from me tonight. So I hope if I can connect with just one person out there, then I think I've maybe achieved something here with this phone call. It started, actually, my Libra story started in 1980 when I am one of four siblings. I am the oldest. And in 1980, I was 33 at the time. 43 at the time. And my brother was diagnosed at age 18 with Leber's at Wills Eye Hospital in Philadelphia, a great eye institute with one of the top neuro-ophthalmologists in the country. And he went through all the terrible diagnosis process that most all of you have gone through, MS and all that sort of stuff, like most of you have encountered along the way. And in 1980, when he got this diagnosis, there was no Leber's history in our family. And at that time, even though he had one of the top neuro-ophthalmologists in the country, there was not that much information they could give us about this disease. And I was not living at home at the time, and I had been married 10 years and had two toddler daughters. And I was not home to see the effects this was having. I went on the computer, and wow, there was, the computer we had at the time was a big IBM computer with this. My gosh, when I think back at those times, the technology was minute compared to what we have these days. And you tried to research Leber's, and I think I came up with one single thing on the computer. It was a big black screen, I remember vividly, with green font, and it was a website from England that gave you some information about Leber's. And it wasn't all that much information. And this is all I had to go by way back then. So I stored this information in my mind and knew it was, oh gosh, they called it, it was on the X chromosome, and it was somewhere along the line they said mitochondrial, but my word, I had no idea what that meant. And we were living at Texas at the time, happy with our two young daughters, and life went on, and so it went. Then I came back to Philadelphia to visit my parents and took my brother to a visit to Will's Eye for a checkup and talked to this excellent neuro-ophthalmologist and decided to have a DNA test because back in 1980, there was no such thing as a DNA. Well, I take that back. There might have been something to a DNA test, but that was never done at that time. So I had a DNA test done, as well as my sister and daughter, and got the results from Athena Labs and came back and said I had a defected gene. The number was 11778, and also a secondary gene, 15257, which Dr. Sergott said was most unusual to have a secondary one as well. And he talked a little bit to me about it and said I should avoid extreme exposure to heat or cold, and to avoid all stress in my life. And what a thing to say to a patient. I mean, how do you go about your life avoiding all stress? And that was just astounding to me, to, supposed to go through life and avoid all stress. And I packed that in the back of my mind and just didn't pay too much attention to that either. And continued on my way. And
I'm sorry. I do hear someone's sweet ringtone. If you don't mind pressing *6 to mute yourself, that would be great.
Yes, please.
Thank you.
So, getting closer to the present day, I knew this was in our family history, but I also knew that this was not supposed to happen to females. This was not supposed to. Therefore, I thought this was not going to happen to me.
I'm so sorry. There's someone in the background. We're having a little conversation. If you don't mind, please *6.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you.
So proceed to the year 2012. I was February of that year. I'm addressing Valentine's and having a difficult time trying to address the Valentine's. Didn't think a single thing of it. I wore contacts and just thought, okay, I'm having a hard time doing this. But as the month wore on in March, I just thought, oh, my gosh, I must need new glasses. I went to my ophthalmologist, and he prescribed a new prescription for me. And at that time, I knew he was looking at my optic nerve, but didn't notice anything. I went to Costco's and got a new prescription. And I went to pick up my glasses, and, oh, my gosh, I got these glasses, and my vision was worse. And I was very worried about this whole thing, and they were nice enough to take the glasses back and give me a refund. And in April of that 2012, our first grandchild was born, my grandson. And in May, I went to spend time in Annapolis with my daughter to help take care of him. And I woke up one morning, and I was really frightened. I just couldn't see very well at all. I called my retina doctor at Wills Eye Hospital because I thought I was getting a detached retina because I had a condition called lattice degeneration, which is you have pinhole dots in the back of your retina, and you can possibly have a tear from one dot to the next, and it's a precursor to a detached retina. And I was so sure that's what was happening to me. Levers never even entered my mind, mind you. So I called the doctor up, and I said, something's happening. And I said, should I go to Johns Hopkins? And he said, no. He said, can you get up to Will's Eye? And my daughter put me on a train, and I was in his office 3 hours later sitting in his chair. And he said, no, he said, your retina's fine. He said, you need to go upstairs 2 floors to see Dr. Surgut. And I thought, oh, my gosh, alarm bells rang. Went up to see Dr. Surgut, and immediately he told me I had levers. And I looked at him. I was 64 years old at the time. This is May 2012, and I started to argue with him. I said, that is not possible. I am a female, and I'm 64 years old. I am not in the bell curve. I am so far out of the bell curve here that I'm a statistical anomaly. Doctor, this can't be happening to me. And he had a circle of doctors accompanying him, and you could have heard a pin drop in this room. And he said, I have never had a female patient this old in my office with this disease. He said, I'm so sorry, Christine, but I am certain that this is what is happening to you. Then he also went on to say that he had a dear friend in California. He said, I'm going to call him. He said, I think maybe perhaps he would like to see you. And he said, would you be interested in going to California to see him? He's the top doc about this. And he got on the phone right away and called Dr. Alfredo Sadoun. And my daughter and her husband live in Los Angeles. So 3 weeks later, I'm sitting in the chair talking to Dr. Alfredo Sadoun. How fortunate I am. And let me stop for a moment and say, throughout all this, I consider myself very fortunate to come down with this disease at my age of 64 is a lucky thing for me. To come down with this at age 64 is I spent most of my life with perfect vision, and so I'm a lucky person that this didn't strike me until this age. I really feel very strongly about this. So as I continue here, I'm talking to Dr. Alfredo Sadoun, and what a wonderful man he is. I can't stress enough how compassionate and caring and how he's dedicated his life to combating this disease for all of us. He's made it his life's mission, and there are no words to tell you how strongly I feel about this. So at this particular time, this was around June 13th, the first LHLN conference is going to be held at Newport Beach. And how fortunate I am that my husband and I are out there at this time. So we decided to attend the first LHON conference. Well, I attended this conference at Newport Beach, and I got to tell you, the speaker list was Dr. Alfredo Sadoun, Dr. Corelli, and Dr. Doug Wallace. Wow, what a rock star lineup. It was just the top researchers in this field talking about LHON and mitochondrial disease. But guess what? I was deer in the headlights. I had just been diagnosed, and this information went in one ear and out the other. So the best thing to become of this conference was my opportunity to meet Lisa Poincinot. Wow, she's a rock star. She's our leader. That's probably one of the luckiest days I've ever had to meet Lisa and get this connection with the LHON family. How lucky can one person be? That's when all I met great people that day, and at that point, I still had vision in one eye, so I can picture the place. I can picture the doctor's faces. It was a great event, and Bob and I have been fortunate to attend all these conferences except one, but they are a terrific thing to go to, and I'll speak about that once again. But that's how I got to my diagnosis, and I really hesitated being a speaker here today, but I thought all of you should know that this can happen to a mature female, so that you can speak to your sisters or nieces that you know, because they need to know what the triggers are, and it may be up to you bring this up to them and start the conversation. It's the fair thing to do. But during my first year that I was diagnosed, was extremely difficult for me. I was very sad and had a hard time coping. Many people who knew me maybe wouldn't have guessed that. Maybe I hid my feelings from them, but my family certainly would have recognized it. And I definitely was depressed, and I had difficulties, and I recognized that, and I knew I needed counseling. So I found a counselor, and that was the right thing to do. I sought out counseling, and I gave it an honest try. I think I went to 10 sessions with her, and she was a very kind person, but it just was not beneficial. I took a break and thought, well, I'm going to try it with someone else. And I must say, we have a great insurance plan, but these are limitations with insurance. Excuse me while I take a sip of water here. The insurance gives you certain doctors you can choose from. Well, I decided, since I couldn't drive, of course, it's only fair when you have to ask people, which is not easy for me to do, that I was going to do this within a 15 to 20 minute radius. I'm not going to ask a friend to drive me further than that. 20 minutes there, boy, that's the maximum, maybe 15 minutes, and 15 minutes back. So there aren't that many doctors I can choose from with my insurance. It's a 15 minutes radius, one way and back. So I didn't have too many doctors to choose from because of this. And so I selected another doctor, and this wasn't going well either. They don't know what a mitochondrial disease is. They do not, neither doctor understood what a mitochondrial blindness situation was about, how this affected me, how the guilt I felt about passing this on to my children. There was no way they were going to understand this. They did not know how to respond to me. I did all the talking. It was just not a good back and forth. So I stopped that. Came back home, and after about 10 months, I decided, okay, Chris, you're just going to have to do this on your own. I pulled myself up by the bootstraps, and I said, I am going to be happy again. And I just had to dig deep within myself and do it. And being hopeful is trying to turn your life around and trying to inspire yourself to be optimistic again. And that's what I try to do. And that's what I'm trying to reach out somewhere here on this phone call and try and tell someone out there that you've all heard the expression, if I can do it, someone else out there can do it. The thing that really gave me the big push to do this was when I attended the second LHON conference, which was held in Pittsburgh. That was just after in 2013, after my one-year anniversary. We went to this conference, and that's where I met my lifelong LHON friends, and a lot of you are on this phone call. You know who you are. That's where I met you all, and you are happy, achieving, brave, strong people. And when I met you, I could tell that, wow, you live full, happy lives, and you set such a strong example for me. And I thought, wow, I like you all so much that I want to be like you. And that was the day I was sure I was going to make it. Jessica?
Yes. I mean, that was, your story is fantastic, Chris. I absolutely love it. You said you weren't inspiring, but you're encouraging and motivating. And it was, I loved it. I loved, like, your story is real. And I love that you were able to share this with everyone. So thank you for being our guest speaker. Since we all are unmuted, if you do want to star 7 yourself, and if you guys have any questions for Chris, or you want to pop in and say something, I would love to have.
There's a couple other things I think I want to say.
Oh, yeah, sure.
When this happened to me, I'd been retired for a year and a half. I was I was a stay-at-home mom. I was an accountant for a while, and then I became a stay-at-home mom. Then I went back to work and was a sales associate for Talbot's, a women's clothier. And I enjoyed wardrobing women and helping them choose their clothes. And it was a very visual thing I did. And I loved working with colors and making them feel good. And so in addition to not driving or reading, one of the things I have always missed the most was losing colors. And I'm a very visual person. And believe it or not, that has really been something I miss so much about this disease, is enjoying the colors we see every day. And that's one part of it. But another thing I wanted to mention tonight, and I don't want the men to hang up, because I know this is a female topic, but it's an important thing I wanted to just highlight a little bit about, and that is that, and I say this, this part about the heredity thing, that women also have to cope with the fact that in addition to coping with the loss of sight, women have to cope with the idea that they have passed this terrible disease onto their children and in some cases to their grandchildren. And I really struggled with that. And believe me, it pops into my head today as I talk to you on the phone. And men, thankfully, and I mean thankfully, don't have to think about this. But think about it in relation to your mothers or your sisters or your aunts, because it is something that they do struggle with. And I just want to bring it to everyone's attention that from a woman's point of view, that is something very important to us as affected or carriers. That is an important issue. And maybe enough said about that. Jessica?
No, yeah, definitely. I mean, definitely, it's hard to think about, for sure, especially being someone that has a gene and carries a gene, definitely. Well, if you don't have anything else you'd like to share, I mean, it was fantastic. Does anybody else want to jump in?
Yeah. Chris, I want to tell you that your story was inspiring. It kind of mimics my story, although I'm a male. Will's Eye Hospital, test after test after test, and finally getting this diagnosis of Leber. Like, what in the world is this? My first question to my doctor was, can I pass this on to my children? And thank God he said, no, it only can come from the female. And I got it at age 66, and I heard you say it was a blessing that you got it when at your age, and that's exactly how I feel. I was able to retire at 59, spend the time from 59 to 66 traveling and doing all kinds of things with my wife and enjoying life, and then it just turned on a dime when I got this disease. So I really appreciate your story tonight.
Thank you. It's nice of you to say.
Hi, Chris. This is Ida from Ottawa in Canada.
Yes.
I met you at
yes.
the 2014 conference, and that was the first one that I attended. And I think I felt like you did at that time. I was kind of devastated. But like you, meeting all those other people or that whole family with Lebers just made me realize, wow, I'm not alone.
Uh-huh.
However, I do recall you and I talking and saying how, well, I got my diagnosis when I was 67. And when I went to my doctor, he said, basically, it was here in Ottawa, he said, I'm going to call my good friend, Dr. Sadoun. In California, although I didn't go to California to see him because he basically confirmed that, yes, that is what she has, especially after the DNA testing. But also, I really appreciate what you said at the end with the guilt of being a mother because, like you, I have two daughters and two grandsons. And that hurts me more than anything. To know that, you know, we passed it on to them, or could, possibly.
Yes, I
am. Whereas, you know, again, like you and the gentleman before us, I appreciate that we've had a life, that we've done things, but, oh, my God, the thought of this happening to my grandsons or my daughters, that's the worst part, I think, of the whole process.
It is, Ida. I know. Well,
I appreciate
I also,
you talking so openly about it and recognizing that there is hope and there is life after this.
That's right. Well, one other comment I'd like to make is that when I met Dr. Sadoun, I came away convinced that I'm not sure I will see it in my lifetime, but all the research that is going on now, I really have hope in my heart that, not in my generation, but that in my daughter's generation and surely in my grandson's generation, that there will be a cure if not a cure, a treatment for this.
That's right.
I really feel strongly about that. And everyone needs to have hope in their heart. And it's so important. And I don't know if I'll see that, but I always have hope.
That's right, yeah. And if
Chris?
You don't have hope,
yes.
That is one thing that we have to have and be optimistic, like you say.
Yes.
Hey, this is Andy, and I'll go ahead.
We have to be an example for our children and our grandchildren. That's my most important thing. You have to show them that life goes on.
That's right, Ida. Yes, Andy?
I just wanted to chime in, and as a guy, obviously, who was passed this by my mom, I'm reminded of her when I hear all of you talk, and while I can't speak for your children, I certainly don't try to do that. I just whether my mom's listening or not. I'm sure she's not, but I'll say to you all on behalf of your children the same way I would expect anyone to say to my mother, that the fact that you all feel this way is touching in and of itself and means that you all have done more for these children in their lives, having a mother as loving as you all are, that we, if we could erase your guilt in any way, we would in a heartbeat, and I realize we can't do that, but I just want to say thank you all, or thank you both, for being fantastic mothers, and you deserve endless hugs from your children, regardless of what happens to them in the future.
Well, thank you, Andy. It's, you know, it's not so much that I feel guilt, because I know I had no control of what's happening here, so it's not so much guilt that I feel. It's more of a worry, a concern, but I don't feel guilt because I have nothing to feel guilty about. So it's not, guilt is not the right word, but it's a deep concern.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's better. That sounds more like it.
I have a question.
Yes.
Well, I'm Serena from California, and I recently came back from a visit with Dr. Sadoun, and it was for my daughter, who's recently, she's 16, and she received a recent diagnosis.
I'm sorry.
And he said he would like to see me as a patient, as I'm nearing menopause years. And
absolutely.
And he said, I should seriously consider HRT, and that estrogen actually protects women. And I was wondering if anyone heard anything to support that.
Well, I'm sorry, what is your first name again?
Serena.
Serena. I know one of the rules of this phone call is not to talk about medical things. So I'm not sure we should venture out there, but Dr. Sadoun did say to my daughters that menopause could be a trigger, the spike in hormones, and that my daughters should not, he said a similar thing. So women who are approaching menopause, it's a good idea to not go through spiky hormone things. And but I believe Lissa can tell us all that if you go through some of the former conferences, Dr. Sadoun did address this issue at our conferences, and you could listen to him on tape. Is that correct, Lissa?
Yeah, it is. And Serena, I can. This is Lissa, and I'd be happy to right after the call, I'll shoot you an email because I've got your email address. And I'll send you two things. One is I have a video clip of just what Chris said where Dr. Sadoun talks about the research on estrogen and HRT, and he expresses probably what you've heard him say in the office, but it's on tape, but it's the same thing. And then I can also send you, there's a published article that he participated in with his Italian colleagues. Some of the folks on the call have been to conferences and heard Valerio Corelli speak, and I don't know if Chiara Lamore just spoke. She was on the panel 1 year, but they participated in a study about estrogen, and the basic concept would be that if you, you know, go back years when people try, when they're trying to figure out why are men affected and women are not, and then why is it that, you know, many women are affected in their 40s and 50s and even 60s when men are more often, you know, affected in the 15 to 30, 25 range. And so this whole estrogen theory is in there. So like I said, I'll send you the article and the video clip so you can read for yourself what's driving him to say that. And the issue about seeing him as a patient yourself, it's a really good thing to do because I think you're in California. You're just a Southwest flight away, and I'm in San Diego. And so it's just a drive up the, you know, 4 or 5 and the 5 to get to him. But it is, you know, not everyone can see someone like him as a carrier, but it's not a bad thing. You know, it's nice to have a few visits with him, ask a lot of questions, gather information, And, you know, he can examine your optic nerves. He can, you know, answer those questions in greater depth for you. So, yeah, I encourage it if you're comfortable doing it.
Yeah, no, I was shocked when he suggested. Actually, he wanted, I also have a son, and he wanted to see him as well. And I see the reasoning behind it, but I was so unprepared for the, just how this diagnosis has changed our whole family dynamic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and I know he's told me, and he's trying to gauge the situation, and like if he tosses it out there and you're comfortable picking up on it, then I think he believes he can provide value if he brings you in as a carrier, as a patient. But not everyone's ready to receive that information, so if you're not comfortable, then he's okay with that too. But he does, you know, it's kind of a respectful thing if he feels that you're ready for it, you know. It can be really helpful.
I'm totally ready for it. I was just like, wow, you know,
right.
it's so much more than what I initially thought it was.
Right, I agree with you. I think it's such an interesting, and I use that word in huge air quotes, but it's an interesting disease because, like Chris was saying, you know, you've got all the issues around, you know, the vision loss, but then you've got, well, how does it feel as a mother and her risks for her children? And then it's like, oh, what about yourself? And it's easy to forget yourself, but as Chris is reminding us, you know, there are, you know, we can be any age and we're at risk also, and that's what he's trying to point out to you as a potential, you know, person who's at risk, and you're probably focusing on your child. You're not thinking about yourself, and so he's trying to bring that up. So yeah, it's. I'll send you some of the backup information. Hopefully that helps.
Yeah, I mean, in the beginning, it was all about my daughter. You know, we were taking her for testing and all the specialists, and then all of a sudden, like, wait, you know, it could be me too. Or it could be my son. It could be,
mm-hmm.
you know, I don't even want to think about that. But just, you know, one day at a time, I guess.
Right. And it's one issue at a time, right? It's like, at least
yeah.
for me, you know, I've got one child who's affected and two who currently are not and hopefully never are. And then myself at risk, but hopefully never am affected, but I'm aware I could be. And yeah, it's like, I think for me about the first 6 months, we're all about stabilizing the situation for the affected one. And I kind of knew that the others were at risk and me too, but it was like, I wasn't ready to deal with that. And then it's like, oh, okay, now let's deal with that. And now, you know, it goes on and on. There's a lot of complexities to this whole issue.
Well, one day, hopefully, I'll be able to attend a conference and meet you all.
That'd be great.
Another thing I would mention that has been a problem associated with this for me is that it's a mitochondrial disease, which is so all-encompassing and complicated. When I go to my family's physician, who I've had for 35 years, and I dearly love this man, it's frustrating for me because when you tack on the word mitochondrial, it complicates every diagnosis. And this is a personal opinion I have here. I don't think most physicians understand how mitochondria affects me, or us. And I've had my neurologist tell me, that he said, when it comes to mitochondria stuff, I don't understand it. This is my neurologist. Okay, that's pretty disappointing, or that's pretty astounding. I wish more physicians understood me as a patient and the mitochondria part of it. I think I have mitochondria issues, and I don't think I'm a hypochondriac. And I think the more research I do into this, I think there's science to back this stuff up. And I find this really, really frustrating. I don't know if any of you do, too. And I think that's another thing that is so confounding. And I think that's another thing that is just so difficult with this with Libras. And I don't know, that's enough said on that. But
Chris,
yes.
This is Jennifer in Minnesota. I do want to thank you for talking about the, not really the guilt, but the feeling you felt for your kids, bringing that up again. But I wanted to share my piece of the story with that is when Michael was diagnosed, and it was almost a year later when I met Lissa at the conference, I asked her when that was going to subside or you'd feel better, because I was going into almost a year of it. And she said, you need to focus your energy on something other than that. And that's when I started planning Dinner in the Dark. And
yes.
And I think for people that are feeling this way, Lissa, I don't know if you remember what you told me, but rechanneling your energy into something positive, I would be more than happy to talk to anybody about how we did Dinner in the Dark. Jessica's done it for years. I mean, any way to raise money to help with research, I think, is a huge piece. And it was a huge piece for me to start changing how I was feeling. So that's just my little piece on it.
I think that's such a good intention, and that can't help but make you feel so good inside.
Oh, it helped out tons, because at least I felt like I was able to do something or help.
That's right. That's terrific advice. Well, my girls have also given me such good feedback that I have such great girls that I have to say.
It's Maria. I wanted to just loop back super quick to having Dr. Sadoun or any neuro-ophthalmologist see the carriers. Another reason that my doctor wanted to see my kids was because he wanted a baseline of their optic nerves so that if, knock on wood, something happened to my children and we went in, he could have something to compare it to. A healthy optic nerve versus one that's starting to, you know, to show signs of LHON. My sister and her boys, all carriers at the time, all saw Dr. Sadoun, got their baselines, and I said it on last call, and unfortunately, my oldest nephew became affected. Now, he just was affected a few months ago, but he was able to go back to Sadoun. Sadoun pulled his file, could see what his optic nerve looked like, you know, 6 months, a year before, whatever it was, and then compare. So he had, you know, a baseline to go from. And I think that's another really important part of having the carriers looked at, just getting those baselines and those records started in case they're needed in the future.
And let me talk about one more reason to have a carrier child be seen by a knowledgeable LHON doctor is that removes the parent from the role of being the pseudo doctor. And when my oldest was affected, I had a 16-year-old daughter and a 13-year-old son who were about to go through some years when they were going to have to make choices about what they wanted to do with certain environmental factors. And it started with mommy reading information on the internet and talking about it at the dinner table. And then it became, well, what does mommy say about this? And I started taking my carrier kids to see Dr. Sadoun. And at that point, I was out of the conversation. And they could have discussions with their doctor, and he could give them information as a doctor. And it was, you know, no judgment, no value, nothing about parental influence. This is just purely, here's, you know, and he's really cool, I can tell you, because my kids, I was in the room, and I heard them ask him some very interesting questions about various things, and a lot of stuff isn't researched, but he would give them his best medical insight as to whether certain environmental factors would or would not be influenced, would they or would they not influence their risk of being converted to affected. And it's between them and the doctor, and it was really valuable for me not to be part of that conversation. That's another piece of it.
You're really right, Lisa. I, too, saw Dr. Karanji here in Ottawa, and he told us that, or told me, that I would like to see your daughters, and eventually when your grandchildren or your grandsons get older, I'll see them as well. He said, I call this a family disease. And the same thing, he wanted at baseline for my daughters, and they've both been to see him. And, yeah, they were free to ask whatever questions, and he did talk to them about HRT and, you know, when you start going into menopause, what we suggest, you know, but to talk to your gynecologist about it if you have other questions, and that he will see them at least once a year or in between if they feel they want to see him, which I think is really great.
I agree with you, Ida, on that notion of having them sort of available and in your corner if you need them, because we had a couple of scares, you know, where, because I think everyone is pretty aware that once this comes up and you know you carry it, you probably start wondering, is it onset or is it just kind of things are blurry? And it's really nice to, you know, be a patient of somebody who knows, and you can contact them and they can talk you through it, or they can send you somewhere for a quick check or something, because you just don't know, and it's hard to get that answer if you don't have a good connection with a good specialist, and setting that up front is a gift you're providing to your other family members.
It definitely is.
Another reason I decided to be open and discuss this is just to make all of you aware that this can strike at any age. Remember, I was 64 when I came down with this. Ida was 67. So just be aware of this. This is the farthest thing from my imagination. I thought I was having a retinal tear, if you recall. So just remember.
I never even heard of the name.
Right. Well, see, in my case, I had a medical history of this, and I still didn't even think this was in the statistics, you know? So you have to be mindful. That's why I wanted to speak about this. Ladies and then listeners.
Chris?
Yes.
It's Susan from Ontario.
Yes, Susan.
And,
how are you?
Good, thanks. And I was diagnosed at 62.
Right, I remember.
There was something I've kind of noticed when we talk about family members who are at risk of converting, and I don't really hear people talk about their parents or grandparents, or, you know, whether it's in their ancestry. And, I was wondering whether it's because maybe people don't know, or is it possible that Lieber's is becoming more commonplace? And, like, I didn't have it in my family that I know of.
It was not, we cannot go back, I personally cannot go back generations. I have a theory that maybe they just didn't have a label for it back then, or maybe they called it optic neuritis. I personally do not have, cannot go back generations. I know that my youngest brother came down with it, and that's when we had a label for it. I have an elderly aunt. When she passed away, she remembers that there was someone in the Civil War who became blind, but, boy, that's just an offhanded memory.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't have any records of it. But I don't know, maybe Alyssa can address this. I just think maybe there's, you know, there was optic neuritis. I don't know if anyone out there can speak to this.
I was going to say that I think that, like in my own experience, we didn't know of it being in our family history, but I do have a maternal uncle who was diagnosed with tobacco amblyopia, which I'm told is no longer a diagnosis. But so it could be that people, you know, had a variety of diagnoses. I mean, even now people struggle to get it correctly diagnosed. So surely in the past it was harder. And the genetic test, Doug Wallace didn't even invent the test until 1988. So anyone diagnosed before that, there was no genetic confirmation available. And it sure took a while to get it commercially available. So even though people made a clinical diagnosis, they didn't have the genetic confirmation until the very late 80s and early 90s. So, going backwards, you're going to find that it would have been hard to be sure of what it was.
What it was, but I don't even know of any blindness in my mother's family, and I haven't heard people talk as though they knew of blindness in their families. So I guess it can skip generations.
It doesn't exactly skip a generation in the sense that people traditionally think of it. I mean, the mutation is present in all the individuals on the maternal bloodline. It's just that it can be that no one's affected. You can have it and just stay a carrier all your life and never convert, and therefore you would have never known about it.
Mm-hmm.
There's varial dominance, right, that Dr. Sadoun talks about.
There's issues around like heteroplasmy and homoplasmy, where 15% of the folks are heteroplasmic and 85% all have the mutated mitochondria, and that's a piece of it. But they're still trying to figure out what it is that makes some people convert and not others. That's still just not known. Yeah.
Hi, this is John in Connecticut, and Susan, your question's a great one. And I live in Connecticut, but I'm from Ontario, and I have a great grandmother from Quebec, and we had one other cousin. I think it was a cousin of my mother's who had some sort of visual impairment, and I've been affected for probably the longest on the call, about 45 years. And he came to Toronto in the 1970s and was examined by various doctors that were helping me at the time, and they said, no, he didn't have the same thing. So now, since then, I have a male and a female cousin, a female at age 50 and a male cousin at age 40 who have been affected. So who knows? But there was nothing really before that in our family, so maybe not very good records.
Yeah, it's interesting.
If you, I just listened today to the very first conference, LHON conference, that was held at Newport Beach, where Dr. Sadoun spoke about the research he was doing with the Brazil family. I don't know if you've all known about this, but he's done extensive research with the Brazil family and the inheritance there. It's so interesting to listen to the research that he did with, or still doing probably, with this Brazil family. Yeah, if you want to listen to this, just Google the Newport Beach LHON conference held June 13th, 2013, and listen to his topic he spoke about there, and you'll get some. You'll find this talk so interesting about this inheritance pattern and the dominance and how it can skip around and whatever. I just listened to it today, and I mean, you can never hear this stuff enough times where you don't pick out something you missed before. The education of research is just, I find, quite so interesting.
Yeah, it is. Chris,
I'm putting a link to that video. I'm putting a link to that in the Facebook group underneath the LHO and Live logo just to make it easier for people to find.
Oh, you're great, Lissa.
Lissa, where is the link? It's underneath the...
If you go to the Facebook group, the global Facebook group, and there's an LHO and Live logo where Jessica announced tonight's call, and so I'm just putting it in the comments there.
Okay. I haven't learned to navigate Facebook all that well yet, but I'm working on it.
Hey, Chris, John in Connecticut again. Thank you again for your talk tonight.
Oh, thank you, John.
Yeah, thanks, Chris. Chris, did you experience the sensitivity to heat and cold that the doctor who saw your brother when he was diagnosed mentioned?
Yes. I should mention I have another brother, too. I don't want to count him out. I have my other brother was just diagnosed in August of 2016. So three out of the four of us have come down with this disease. I want to get that in. I didn't want to not mention my brother, other brother. But yes, I have.
Excuse me, Chris.
Yeah, that's my brother Brian. Shout out.
This is Brian, and I'm a proud brother this evening. That's for sure. I just want to say that. I had Chris before she got it, when she just got it, and the person she is now, and clearly this is the strongest person she's ever been, and I'm just so proud of my sister. And I just want to say, as a brother who saw a younger brother get it at 18, and a sister get it, and here I am, I'm playing golf, having a good time, drinking with my buddies. I didn't understand. I'd never realized exactly what they were going through. So I have quite a bit of guilt about that right now. And now that I understand it, I'm even more proud of my sister. So I just appreciate what you did tonight, Chris. And that's all I'll say. Tonight's your night.
Thank you, Brian. When Brian got diagnosed, I was... brought to tears because I thought, my word, another member of our family has come down with this. This was so awful that this should happen to someone else. But I got to confess, 75% of me was just feeling so dreadful that Brian now came down with this. But 25% of me was reliving my own diagnosis again. How bad is that? I mean, but I was. It was like, oh, no. I mean, these feelings sprang up for me again, like, oh, no. So I was feeling so horrible for Brian, and yet it was renewing what I went through again. I was feeling so conflicted. It was like, wow, this is so awful for our family. Like, no. This is such a bad, bad gene. Like, go away. My God. It was a terrible time. But getting back to your question, dysautonomia. Lisa put me onto this. It's another tricky thing with mitochondria. Yeah, cold intolerant and heat intolerant. This cold weather is like messing with your mitochondria. It just is you feel really cold, and my normal body temperature is 97.4. I don't feel warm. I feel chilled all the time. And
yeah.
And when the temperature outdoors is 4 degrees, I need to go visit you, Wayne, in Florida.
The temperature outdoors is 4? Well, that would be 4 Fahrenheit. It's quite a bit colder here, I think. But, yeah, I experienced that too. Before I even had a loss of vision, I started becoming very sensitive to cold.
Yes.
And being like I have a horse, and I'd be out in a cold barn in the wintertime or even outdoors riding, and for many years it didn't bother me. And then starting about 4 years ago, I couldn't handle it in my extremities, the cold, so I had to get heated gloves. And
well,
without
look up,
them, I...
Look up dysautonomia and see if that sounds familiar. Dysautonomia.
Okay. Is that D-Y-S?
Yes.
Okay.
Lissa, you can probably put a link up for that, right?
I'm working on it.
Of course. Hi, everyone. This is Richie from Australia. David, I've had a bit of contact with the mitochondrial network here in Adelaide, and some of the people here with other mitochondrial diseases really feel that. Some of them like feel cold every single time, like all the time they feel cold. Only start to feel less cold when it hits around like 35 degrees, which is about 100 Fahrenheit. So they'll be wearing scarves in the middle of summer. It's quite common, I think. Yeah. But I find it quite interesting that people with LHON have experienced that too.
So what about the heat in Australia, Richie?
Well, right now it's probably about 30 degrees, and I don't find the heat too bad. I do find the way my body heats up, usually when I've been walking in the heat or exercising, that's when I find my start is a bit worse. But I think everybody notices that. But apart from that, the heat I don't find too bad. It doesn't worry me too much.
Hey, Richie, it's gone in Connecticut. Just to be clear, that's 30 Celsius, right?
30 Celsius, yeah, today, yeah.
So a lot of Americans on the phone who think in Fahrenheit.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think 30 Celsius is, well, 35 Celsius is around 100 Fahrenheit. So, yeah, so we're
yeah, 30 is about 85, I think, if Fahrenheit.
Yeah. And also, while I'm talking, if I can just switch topics and mention what Chris is talking about and other people are talking about, Dr. Sadoun. I went and saw him when I came to the US for the conference this last year. And I found him amazing. I really would recommend anyone who's got doubts about what their doctor's telling them or just needs a bit more understanding to go and see him, because he really is amazing. I saw quite a few doctors here in Australia, and I found that they just don't really understand the emotions, as Chris was saying, like the emotion behind losing your sight, and said some really amazing things and cool things as well, and where Sadoun is quite the opposite, and I would highly recommend people, if they have doubts about their doctor, to go and see him, because he is wonderful. And also, like he also, because he does so much research, you can actually trust any answers to questions you ask, where I can't do that here in Australia. I had one of my doctors recently tell me that my brother's children would have the gene and are liable to become affected, which flies in the face of everything else we know. But that doctor is otherwise considered one of the best in town. And she's a really good scientist, but she obviously just doesn't really understand it completely.
Chris,
this is
Zed in New Jersey. I am so glad you just said something about being cold all the time.
Yes.
I thought I was going crazy. My wife is constantly turning the heat down. I'm constantly cold.
I'm so sorry. I think there must be someone that's on mute. Sorry, we can't hear it. Oh, what part are they speaking?
Is that Ida?
Hello?
Ned, try again.
Hello?
Yes, please try again. They're speaking beautiful language. Excuse me, can you hear us?
Yes.
Oh, all right. So try again.
Hello?
Okay, are you there? Yep. We're ready for you again.
Ned?
Zed.
Zed.
Okay.
Yes. Now, I was just saying about the cold. I am always cold. And my wife keeps saying, like, there's something wrong with you. The heat is on 75. How can you be cold? And I'm always cold.
It's your body thermostat, I bet. Check the link that Lissa is posting.
Okay.
That sure explains why I'm out of whack.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Does anyone have Raynaud's disease? Like their fingers become so cold that they lose feeling in them and they turn blue?
And that's what you're doing?
This is Maria. It can't Raynaud's happen to fingers and toes?
Toes, yes. Yeah.
My feet become ice blocks and my fingers all the time.
Yes.
But I didn't know if it was severe enough, quote unquote, to be Raynaud's or what. But I literally, my feet, they're almost numb half the time. Not neuropathy or anything like that, but literally so freezing cold. I actually have to put a heater at the bottom of my bed to thaw them out, if you will, before I go to sleep. I just thought, well, that's just me, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if that's part of it or not,
sure,
part of this thing that they're talking about. I'm going to have to read it.
Cashmere fingerless gloves, Maria.
Of course. The best.
Now that sounds fantastic.
And, you know, and actually it's kind of weird. My sister has been diagnosed with Raynaud. So, I don't know. Maybe it's not really Raynaud. I don't know. Anyway.
Well, I definitely don't want to cut her short, but I do want to have respect for those that maybe do have to get off the call. It is a little bit past 7, I think. 15 minutes past 7. So I want to respect those that do have to go, and thank you guys for staying on the line. And, Chris, you are absolutely fantastic, and I am so happy that we had you as a guest speaker. But if you do want to hang tight, I'm just going to stop recording the call, but please feel free to hang tight, and we'd love to continue the discussion. But just give me a couple seconds. But, Chris, thank you very much for being here tonight. I'm so glad that we got you to be a guest speaker because you were absolutely fantastic. And thank you for helping us shed a little different light for the RH1 community and being a great sign of encouragement and a spice of motivation. So thank you.
You're welcome, Jessica.
One second.